It's a very great pleasure and a privilege for me, actually for the second time, I'm very pleased to say, to introduce our speaker this evening, the High Commissioner in Britain of India, His Excellency Mr. Kamalesh Sharma. His Excellency is actually a graduate of King's College, Cambridge, and before that, of an institution which will be well known to some in this audience at least. His Excellency is from a secret society known as that of the Stephanians, in other words, a graduate of St. Stephen's College in Delhi. And he has been a distinguished member of the Indian Foreign Service for a long time. And he has very considerable experience in multilateral context as well. He has been the permanent representative of India to the United Nations in Geneva, and was for 5 years India's permanent representative to the United Nations in New York. He's been ambassador to the German Democratic Republic and was the first ambassador to the Central Asian Republics of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, and has served as well in Bonn, in Hong Kong, in Saudi Arabia, and in Turkey. I think that before coming to take up his position as High Commissioner here in London, Mr. Sharma was the Secretary General's, that is, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Special Representative to East Timor as Under Secretary General. Mr. Sharma has many interests, and he was actually originally a graduate in English literature and for a time an academic in English literature, and one of his books is actually a poetry collection called Mille Fleurs, poetry from around the world. I think we could have no better, no finer speaker here this evening on the topic that His Excellency will be speaking on, which is future challenges to Indian foreign policy. I think the last thing that I shall say is that His Excellency will be speaking this evening off the record, and I have known on previous occasions that His Excellency has spoken very frankly in this auditorium, but it is, please, off the record. So, without further ado from me, sir.
Thank you very much, Juan. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, sorry. I was saying that I'm afraid I'll have to sit and speak rather than stand, because I'll have to sip this glass of water very frequently. I've had this, I think many people in London are felled by hay fever, I'm one of them. And I hope it's on the way out, but it still troubles me a lot. And thank you for giving me such a fulsome introduction. One of the troubles of my station in life now is how to put forward a CV which doesn't tend to read more like an obituary. But I am a retired person, and I have my service behind me now, and so it is from experience that I say that it's a very dangerous terrain when you start speaking about the foreign policy of a country. It's something I actually avoid doing. But in the LSE, you chaired a session when I spoke on globalization. And before that, I spoke on India's economy. So there was nothing left for me but to speak on this. Thank you. You keep on inviting me. It's most kind of you to do that. Because when you speak of foreign policy, it's a bit like nailing a pudding onto the wall, or entering the Amazon without a guide. But what I intend to do is to draw the differences between what Indian foreign policy looked like half a century ago, the time of independence, and what is the situation now. Many students of foreign policy and diplomacy have heard, I think it may be from Harold Nicholson, I think most of these citations are ascribed to him, at least he quoted it, that a country doesn't have any permanent friends, and a country has only permanent interests. And that was all very well in a world where the interests were very clearly definable. I suppose after the Congress of Vienna you could say that, because you could for many decades have a system of the balance of power and no one wanted to upset it. And you could also say that during the Cold War, when most of the formations of the world look like they'll be with us during our entire lives, which is the East-West polarity, the theory of containment, the two poles opposed to each other, the non-aligned movement wanting not to get involved in this polarity, finding some political space for itself. This looked like a pretty permanent world, and you could say that we have a permanent interest in not doing this or that. Very difficult to say that now, because the world has become so volatile and in such a flux. And the second difficulty in talking about permanent interests is, what is your interest? If you could define your interests as not disturbing the balance of power or not being sucked into superpower rivalry, that was all right. But what is your interest now? Today, people talk about failed states or near failed states. There's hardly any study. It doesn't talk about it, what constitutes a failed state. And these are studies on foreign policy. They're talking entirely about the domestic policy of a country. So in India, the great formations in our foreign policy, to begin with, had these features. The first one was that it was in a post-colonial context. And the first thing which we wanted to do after getting independence was to define our own policy ourselves. This is what our Prime Minister said to the nation when he addressed the Parliament. He says, no longer is Indian foreign policy going to be made in the chancelleries and courts of Europe or elsewhere. And he's the one, in fact, who was one of the authors, among others, of the non-aligned movement, which says that we have suffered enough with the disputes which have been inherited in this part of the world, and we don't want any part of it now. As far as the economic policy was concerned, it was also a reflection of a post-colonial desire of two things. One, not to see the family silver go out anymore. Enough of that had happened. There was enormous transfer of resources. And the other was self-reliance to the extent possible. There's a great remembrance of all that India had been in the world. We hear it now again in the new era of globalization, that in the year 1800, half of the world's product was supplied by India and China. That India was in fact associated only with exports. It's only after independence our policy became not export-led for some reason. But a Roman emperor is believed to have said, I don't want import from India, it's ruining my treasury. There was a book on mathematics which came out in Portugal in 1505. They said, this is a newfangled science, but you have to learn it, because if you don't, you can't trade with India, and so on. This is a very long history of India being a trading country, but in the immediate post-colonial era, we said, we have to build up our strengths once again. So you had a policy of import substitution, make everything yourself, self-reliance. Because there was a shortage of capital, there was not much private industry, there was some, not very much, the state had to make the heavy investments in steel, in heavy electricals, in machine tools. So it had to be a policy which was based on socialism. We were open to the idea of having these investments from the north. But it didn't work out like that because we suffered a couple of rebuffs here And then the policy pretty much settled down into saying, if you want to build up your capacity in industry, you'll have to do it yourself. Interestingly, this was also a time when we invested not only in manufacturing ability, but also in services. And this is interesting because whatever you may say about Nehruvian socialism, and I think, as they say here, you know, that part of our history usually gets a bum rap because of some of the inefficiencies and the cost factors which were introduced into the system. But many people realize now, in fact, this just yesterday I heard the theory which says that you begin with protectionism anywhere in the world, and it's only later that you integrate with the rest of the world, and hardly any country is an exception to that. But India somehow gets criticized for this more than it deserves to be. But one of the interesting investments we made was not to simply be dazzled by hardware, to say, we want to make our own engines, we want to make our own steel, our machine tools, heavy electricals, pylons, everything. We said we also want to have the software, the engineering ability, design ability, which goes with it. There was a lot of criticism of this policy at that time. And people said, you know, you can't feed yourself, your literacy rate is what, in single figures, you should be doing what we call the social agenda, which is a good point. But I think the criticism went too much into the direction of, why are you investing in these tertiary sectors, into polytechnics and institutes, institutes of technology, institutes of management, universities. But Nehru had a very clear picture of India. And that picture said that whatever anyone else in the world can do, Indians can do themselves. And we are not going to take it sequentially. We're not going to say we're going to reach A point and then from A to B point, then we'll transit that point and do it like that. So he says, no, we're going to have our own nuclear stations, we're going to have our own space industry, everything. This investment, in fact, is what has brought you the rewards today. When people talk of what the Indian profile is, they forget that the investment was made 50 years ago. And something interesting happened, which is that because of the dot-com bust, all of your broadband width became available overnight in your optic fiber cables, and you could do uplinking through satellites. You bypassed a very antediluvian physical infrastructure. And suddenly what was not tradable before became internationally tradable. This is a huge shift in international global relations, to which I'll come in a minute. But we have to acknowledge here that if India is seen in a different way in the world and it affects your foreign policy, it was really an investment in domestic policy, which is why the two are so inseparable and so artificial to separate the two. In the end, what you do for yourself at home translates and mirrors into what you're able to do for yourself abroad. And this was the investment which was made in that period. Planning, certainly. But you know, planning wasn't a dirty word in those days. There used to be learned essays written by MIT saying, will the Soviet model overtake the capitalist model of America? This was a very serious question of the 30s and the 40s. And with our colonial experience, when a lot went out from India simply to ensure that profit somewhere else in the north could be ensured, planning looked like a good way because you had so many disabilities and infirmities that you planned your way out of them. And much of the strength which you have, many strengths which you have, still come from the era of planning. But there was a sense of disempowerment overall. We wanted to compensate for this disempowerment in some of the ways I've mentioned, but we also found international formations to address this question of disempowerment. The disempowerment was national, but it was also collective. And the non-aligned movement basically was an agent for amplification of the voice of the disempowered during the colonial era so that their voice would be heard. And if they had the same worldview, that voice would be amplified. because you were speaking the same language. In the group of 77, this disempowerment was expressed in economic terms when you made a group and you said you have a special case, and it was accepted in GATT, for instance, special and differential rules were introduced, generalized system of preferences were introduced for trading and other things. And these two forms of disempowerment were addressed for many decades through the agency on the political side of the non-aligned movement, which was a strong aspect of the Indian foreign policy, as of many other countries, and on the economic side through the group of 77. Now, I want to come to some of the points relating to the transformation that has taken place and where we are in this worldview and this particular anchoring of Indian foreign policy. Larry Summers, whose fortunes no doubt people in this university have followed through his various statements in Harvard, was in Davos this year, and he made a statement to the effect that the changes which we are experiencing in the world today are no less in significance and potential outcome than the ones that took place during the era of the Reformation and the Industrial Revolution. The only reason we are not able to see the magnitude of the transformation is because we are inside it. He says, I dare say, people who were actually doing the work of the Industrial Revolution and the steam engine onwards didn't know what a great historical transformation globally was taking place, where they were, which we do in hindsight. And he says, we are embedded in this process, so we don't know. But we have more knowledge than before of historical processes, so we should be able to make a commentary in the world we're in, transformations that are taking place. Now, Martin Wolf was the same conference, and I read it in his column in the Financial Times. He said, I don't know about other pronouncements of Larry, but he had a point when he said this. And you, each one of you, have read so much of the transformation which is underway in the world today. Call it what you like. You can call it a tectonic shift. You can haul up any of these great phrases and descriptions indicating huge transformation. Call it a seismic shift. You can call it a paradigm shift. Whatever you wish to call it, it's one hell of a shift. The first shift is in the disappearance of the East-West polarity, on which the earlier foreign policy of so many newly developing countries, was based. This has forced every country, including what they call the sole superpower, to think of what kind of a world order is it that is going to be substituted for a world order that posited itself on these two polarities. What constitutes your place in the world today? The second polarity which we had was the North-South. Now this carries on because the disempowerment of the South has not gone. But the North and the South, in our minds, were a gestalt phenomenon. When we spoke about this phenomenon, I think, whether consciously or not, if you thought of a geographical formation, the North was Europe, Americas, Australia, New Zealand, Japan. And then there were some new entrants, like Korea. The North was largely that. Now, North as a geographical idea has evaporated. And the geography of North is having to adjust to this highly uncomfortable fact in any way they can. And they're trying to cope with it. And what has happened really is what I alluded to earlier, which is that tens of millions of people have entered the job market in the entire spectrum of economic transactions today that were not there before. And today, if you look at a northern advantage, it is very difficult for you to think, what can be my advantage unless I ally myself to some capacity in the south? So, in your foreign policy today, India is having to do two things. One is to look at its intrinsic strength and not look at the world outside to define what constitutes a strength. In the Cold War, everyone in the North spoke about values and interests. Our policies are that we should pursue our interests and our values, but in fact, the two diverted very quickly. But the talk about values, today, the front-loading of values has become a much more serious consideration. What does democracy mean? What does stability mean? What does durability mean? What does ownership of policy mean? Management of grievances internally and in the world. Mediation of disputes. In other words, your foreign policy posture depends so much today, I made an allusion to what's called the failed states, depends so much today on what you are able to deliver and manage in your domestic policy. This obviously has a carryover into your economic policy as well. There is a big debate between India and China. China has huge indicators ahead of India in many areas. But many people are saying in the end, there will also be a question of coherence. There will be a question of durability and sustainability of what you are doing. And core strengths of efficiency, of delivery. Because one of the issues being raised is that if India is getting $6 billion as investment, China is getting $60 billion as investment, why is it that the growth rate of the two countries is comparable? These questions are being asked. So once again, what is it you do internally, both in your political and your economic performance, becomes an aspect of your foreign policy. So India is being required to address this question in the same way. Another great departure since those times has been in the regional focus. We have seen that it is wrong to think that countries by themselves can advance with the region staying behind. You can certainly do it up to a point. A large country like India has advantages because it's on a subcontinental scale. But the lesson which is being learned is that you have to create in your region a positive sum game in which everyone participates in it. It started with ASEAN, which had inherited a lot of conflicts, and we remember some of these conflicts between the states who then saw the reason of collective action. It went to other countries as well. In Mercosur, the adversarial relationship with sometimes existed between Argentina and Brazil and the other countries. So Paraguay, Uruguay, and they said, look, we have to do things in a very different way. In SADC, in South Africa, they are doing it in the same way, and many of the plans are very effective. In ECOWAS in West Asia, in West Africa, they're trying to do, in East Africa, they're trying to do the same, many other formations. In India, we have South Africa, we have SARC. And SARC, I handled for a while. People used to say nothing is happening in SARC. And my argument always used to be that this is a vehicle for the countries of the region to use when the time is ripe. But let us at least give a message in principle that this is the route you want to take. And I think the time is coming when this route is becoming more and more viable. It's extremely important for us, particularly in the relationship between India and Pakistan, to go and stay the way we are traveling which is to close the chapter on past animosity, to keep on building the confidence, building measures which on which we are embarked, to see that all of the difficulties we have between ourselves bilaterally are resolved in a constructive spirit with full political commitment from both sides, because both countries have a historic opportunity which should not be lost at the present point of time. Yesterday I saw a very interesting presentation. To give you one example, this is about the demography of the world. And there was a huge global chart projected on the screen. And this was what the world will look like in 2020. And the demography showed that many of the dynamic economic societies today are going to have a net shortfall of in employment, in working hands, in labor, and in the youth being able to carry on their dynamism. And a value had been given to each one of them. In Japan, in America, even in China, it was negative. The three areas which looked like they could be able to provide this manpower to global industry were Latin America, Africa, and South Asia. In all countries of South Asia, the indicators were up. This is the time for us to make an investment in the intellectual capital of these countries, so that with every year you engage yourself and you embed yourself in positive sum globalization and integration with the world, so you can take advantage as people of the time which is in front of us. India, in its foreign policy, carries a responsibility to answer the question of smaller neighbors, even though some are very substantial in their own right in population, as to what their concerns are, because our market is big. And what you want to offer is the advantages of the market, and what you don't want to offer is nervousness that the markets of these countries could be adversely affected. Now in SAFTA, the South Asian Free Trade Agreement, which we have a lot of years to plot our way ahead, but we have now to do these alliances in trade, in investment, and in services. Another area for Indian foreign policy which emerges because of its strength is the area of carrying forward in its policy the responsibility towards what constituted its own constituency, with which it showed solidarity in the past, which is the countries of the South. We were all equal in a sense of disempowerment, which I referred to when we became independent. But India and many other countries of the South have come a very long way. It is therefore in our foreign policy incumbent upon us not only to talk of the North-South paradigm in terms of transfer of resources, technology, but also to think and think creatively on how it is that India can do more in terms of its resources and capabilities vis-a-vis the South. We have a plan of the Government of India which is very active in this regard. We do a considerable amount, but there's always a lag between what you can do and between conceptualizing what you should be doing. And I think our foreign policy should be more focused on this. I'll give one example. Your ICT capabilities today are such that we were able to offer to Africa what's called an AfricaNet facility. This means that through one of your satellites and through other software which you give to country, you connect all of their centers of government, all of the institutes, and all of the universities so that they can talk to each other at the same time. It's like a continental conferencing facility. And there are other aspects of it. And I think that is through the medium of various agencies that do exist, including the Commonwealth, India has started to do more, and I think India should keep on doing much more on this track as a very strong aspect of its foreign policy. A recognition of mutual vulnerability is a new phenomenon in the world. In the 50s and the 60s, you could speak of the North and the South, or the East and the West, in political and economic terms, not only in the sense of geography, which I mentioned, but in another sense, which is, we are self-sufficient enough for nothing which can originate where you are to bother us. The transformation of mutual vulnerability today in the world is possibly the greatest transformation requiring an evaluation as to what it means in terms of the global economic order. We know all about climate change. What the developing country does, we're all contributing to the quality of the nest we're in. What the developing country does, and the developed countries do together, is going to be the collective policy. There cannot be an authorship of policy on climate change and global warming which is restricted to one or the other. Now, I don't want to go through the whole agenda of these dependencies, which are both positive and negative, from the uncivil society, as it's, we know about the civil society, terrorism, disease, narcotics, arms, migration. All of this interrelationships of threats means that a country like India, with its size, which will become central to all of them, must have a view which it promulgates and advances of what constitutes a creative and a positive multilateral system. Right now, the United Nations, as an agency, leading agency for this, is under enormous pressure. And I think it has to be one of the main objectives of our foreign policy to see that collective conduct in the understanding that we have collective threats for which we need collective solutions is advanced in every way possible, and India makes a contribution. Now, it is true that we have also said that all aspects of collective organization require reform, including the Security Council. But there are many bodies of the United Nations where this is an urgent task. As far as the Security Council is concerned, I had something to do with it. I was 5 years ambassador in the UN. Our position is that what the Security Council does today is so much related to the developing world that the formation of the Council has become a very important aspect of its credibility as a whole. If you look at the agenda of the Security Council, more than 90% pertains to the developing countries. The Charter says peace and security is what the Council must do. But peace and security was understood in terms of violent conflict in a very different way in the 50s. Now the Council itself has expanded their understanding of what constitutes peace and what constitutes security. They talk about human security. In peacekeeping operations, they talk about nation building. How is it that you have sustainability of an economy and a people which are left behind after the peacekeeping event is over? So the Council itself has been having sessions on this expanded notion of peace and security of the developing world. They're also now passing resolutions in creating tribunals in the developing world. And I think, as so many people have said, the Prime Minister of this country in Washington said it 2 years ago very, very strongly. They said, yes, there are political difficulties, but this is an objective which the world must follow for roughly the reasons which I have been mentioning. Because human action is imperfect, but at least the world should be able to understand that the Council is now constituted in a way that the experience of a variety of countries feeds into the decision which the Council takes. Now, our view is that whenever the world body feels that the time is ripe, whenever they have worked out the modalities, they will find that whatever principles they want to apply in the discussion, India will be central to that discussion. And as and when this event happens, we'll see. Right now, it doesn't look like, at least in the present session, anything much is going to happen in this area. But it is this larger context of what the Council is doing, what the General Assembly is doing, what the UN is doing in all of these areas, which requires the attention of the world community as a whole. As far as the new world is concerned, which is upon us, and I'll conclude on that point. I think that the world is going to see a new knowledge architecture, which is emerging. The role of India is going to be central to any aspect of that architecture. If you look at what constitutes an economic spectrum of activity, you start with agriculture. India has, I think, 11% of the world's arable land. It has much more arable land, in fact, than China has. India is number two producer in fruits, number two producer in the world in vegetables. China is number one in both, despite having much less land. The policy on agriculture in India is just beginning. We are beginning to see that we must link that small plot of land with high and added value so that the supply chain elsewhere in the world can be connected with it. We must not think that all we need to produce is grain for self-sufficiency. We declared the Green Revolution, declared victory. We didn't take the logic further. You may have seen the article which came last 4 days ago in the International Herald Tribune, which said that in another 15 or 20 years, what might happen in India in agriculture is going to put what's happening in IT in the shade. Rabobank, which is the agricultural bank of Netherlands, has said even in another 6 or 7 years, I think the year they said was 2012, the agricultural export from India should be about $30 billion. When you look at manufacturing, you may again have seen also last week a series of three articles which came out on manufacturing in India. One of them was, of course, comparison between India and China. And they said that in high-value manufacturing, it's astonishing how quickly India has moved forward. New terms are now being invented. Lean manufacturing. Service-linked manufacturing. Digitalization-linked manufacturing. Customized manufacturing. But all of these terms are responding to one phenomenon. The time cycle of products is shrinking. People are breathing down your neck to see what's on the market, how can it be improved, how can I have my product there. So the imprint and the content of design, intelligent design in that product has to be a continuous one, and it cannot be a silo of manufacturing which is separate from a silo of services which goes into manufacturing. The two are becoming one activity. As far as services is concerned, you've seen the phenomenon in India. It's moved up from back office and call centers. Within 2 years, the new terms have come up. From call centers, you went to business process outsourcing. From there, engineering process outsourcing. Now, knowledge process outsourcing. This is the velocity of change with which the globalization of the service industry is taking place. In this country, 21,500 IT worker visas, work permits were issued last year, 85% went to India. Knowledge industry is just a gleam in people's eye. Nobody knows what it means. but they know that it means the translation of an idea into a product. In whichever way it takes place, technology spin-off taking place in whatever way. So these are the four areas in which economic activity takes place: agriculture, manufacturing, services, knowledge industry. India has enormous strengths in all four, and the important point to register is it's not a maturity model, an old mature civilization finally coming to something and delivering something. It's a startup model. In agriculture, we've barely got started. In manufacturing, we have got started. We got strengths in six or seven items. Services, everyone knows. Knowledge industry, we know. So if you are making waves when you're getting started, what would the position be in 15 or 20 years? Which is why many of these think tanks, who are very conservative, who say on the one hand this, on the other hand that. I think it was Keynes who said, give me a one-armed economist who just gives me truth as it is, say one on the one hand, on the other hand. These very conservative bodies like McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, banks, all of them are positing where India is going to be in 15 or 20 years because they see these two facts. No matter which part of economic global expansion you're looking at, India has that strength. And in capacity, and India has that strength to build up in the future, if for no other reason for the demography, which I had mentioned. This becomes a huge challenge for your foreign policy in the years to come, which is that you are, whether you like it or not, an integrating economy and nation in the world system. There's no other choice, there's no other way which India can go. Luckily, Indians are born globalists. The image of India, both politically and economically, tends to be arrested in the 20-25 years after independence, when some of our policies, for understandable reasons, were very inward, absorbed, autarkic, if you like, policies but that is not your national genius or aptitude. Your aptitude in your philosophy and everything else is to be outward looking and to be universalist. And therefore I feel that India should not have a difficulty in adjusting to its increasing and globalizing role, both on account of values which I have mentioned, in which respect, with all the difficulties, the management of grievances, the turbulence which you see every day, through which our politics is being conducted, and the challenges on us through which our economics will be conducted. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for that very interesting overview. His Excellency will, I know, be very happy to take questions from members of the audience. I think there are a couple of mics circulating. So first over here, seems the back row has it, but I think let us sort of make our way along the back row.
You rightly pointed out that India today is a much more prosperous and well-to-do economy than what we were in the 1950s. But India's role in the international system is a fraction of what it was in the 50s and the early 60s. Under Jawaharlal Nehru, India played a very important role in mediating conflicts in Korea, Indochina, and in Congo. Where are we today, and why?
I'm not sure whether that's entirely true, to be perfectly honest. India's role was a prominent one because it was a country which was seen to be prominent within a group of countries, which is non-aligned countries, which were being wooed and where in the zero-sum game of the Cold War, both the Soviet Union and America and the Western world wanted to win influence. Also, at that point of time, the stock, which is very strong now, had already started, which is about democracy. Because that polarization was not only in terms of power, it also in terms of ideology. Where would democracy go and which way would communism go? So there were these two elements which made India very prominent in those days. But I would suggest that neither of these elements is gone. Because now, when I was in New York, many of these ambassadors used to come to me and quite honestly say that, you know, a great encouragement from the South, of course, great encouragement to us. They weren't speaking of India as a role model because they read the newspapers, you know, they knew it was a very difficult way in which Indian democracy was progressing. It wasn't all smooth sailing. But they said, you know, this idea is always in our head that if so many people can say that despite being poor, we're not going to abridge our basic freedoms, then surely we should be able to do that too. And many people now in the North realize it too. The great confrontation we have in the world today, part of the reason is not partly a clash of civilizations, but partly a clash of perceptions of what is doable and not doable, and what transition a country can make. And many of the countries in the South have been saying that when the North talks about democracy, it's all very well, but we know past history, it goes for many centuries, and the way the world is now organized, they seem to live on another planet. What is the point of compatibility between Africa, for instance, and the northern world today? But Africa sees a lot of compatibilities with India. Many parts of India are lower in social indicators than sub-Saharan Africa. Our poor is about 250 million. The largest component of the poor in the world is in India. So the lesson which you have, both as an economy, which despite everything can have a national policy and forge ahead in the way I have mentioned, and both the act of faith you have in your political system as being participative, consultative, built on institutions, and having regular transfer of power, people having a real choice. Choices you put, a transition which I think everyone must have mentioned it to me as a miracle in the UN was, how did you do an electronic-based election? And you transited in 5 years? And it became a bit of a joke because you say, we see in Florida people holding up chads and seeing whether it's perforated or not. But there was no political problem in India. Part of it, of course, is the spirit. The Prime Minister said, this is a new system. You can raise questions about it. The people have spoken. I have heard. I am a caretaker Prime Minister. That's what this means. But the truth is that you did it. On an elephant, this machine was going because you didn't want to make a single exception, even in the remotest of areas. So there is this commitment to make democracy not a fraud or a sham, but to make it a very real gain which you have, which must be expressed in every way. So I think I wouldn't say that India, in the perception of the outside world today, is any less than in the 50s. In fact, the counter argument could be made that in a much more difficult world, perhaps this perception is stronger than it was before.
Please. You mentioned about a lot of the strengths that the Indian economy has, both domestically as well as in the global world. It'll be interesting to understand your views on what you might think might be some of the major weaknesses that the Indian economy would face going forward in its international relations.
As I said, you know, it's your weaknesses in the end are going to be sorted out domestically. But if you can do it successfully, then it'll be seen as a strength abroad. I see the major weaknesses as the following: participative, social ownership across the nation of the economic direction of your policy. You cannot have a policy, and ironically, this, if all of you are poor, everyone sees everyone is a poor, these divisions and stresses increase when people start seeing that one group of people is doing so much better than they are. And if they start feeling they'll never be on this bandwagon and mainstream, then they become a dissident group inside your country. You can't afford to have any such dissident group. And therefore, what it means in practical terms is that the rewards of growth cannot be lopsided. The rewards of growth, you have to understand that growth is an instrument only of human dignity and social justice. If that is not being provided by growth, then growth in itself is only a figure. And the Prime Minister is aware of it. His rural employment scheme, the stress he raises in primary and secondary education, and how to pull up agriculture as a matter of priority, the infrastructure. Agriculture in India today, because of your roads, by the time it reaches the market, most of it is bruised and finished. You don't have areas where you can refrigerate it. So your biggest asset in that part of your country, which feels neglected, is undeveloped. So you have to move quickly and do that. People must be able to feel that there may be a time lag before you are included in the benefit of what's going on. But it's only a time lag. It's not an omission. And the other thing, of course, is employment. The areas I have mentioned, some of them bring employment, some of them bring lots of rents and rewards, but not employment. And 8 or 9 million people entering your economy, you cannot, as some industrialists said, because Indians are very confident now of high-value manufacturing. And one of them said, if you want to make Barbie dolls, don't come here. What he was saying was, large-scale manufacturing, that's not our strength. But you have to make that into your strength. Otherwise, you won't be able to absorb a large number of youth which is coming out. And you don't want a voice or a vote of disaffection from the youth.
First, there on the back. 2, 3, 4. Okay. 5. Please remember your number.
You want to do it collectively?
I think I was going to say, could I take... Three at a time.
Your Excellency, I have two questions for you. Firstly, how can we possibly see a long-term mutual relationship with Pakistan outside the context of Kashmir? While we might be able to make small inroads towards cooperation, I think in the long run it would be difficult for both India and Pakistan to come to a mutual agreement on Kashmir. And shouldn't this perhaps be one of the largest challenges to Indian foreign policy? That's the first question. The second question is, what exactly do you see as India's role in the non-aligned movement today? How possibly can India claim to represent the underdeveloped and the countries that have been left out when we are at the same time attempting to join the UN Security Council? And how possibly can we say that our future foreign policy is outside of foreign pressure when we enter into agreements such as the recent Indo-US nuclear deal?
Please. Over here, please. And then over there.
Sir, you mentioned innumerable times today that India's strength lies in its vast knowledge and industry. I would like to know your reaction to the proposed increase in reservations by the present government. How do you see this affecting FDI? How do you see this affecting people like me who are thinking whether I should go back, whether I have a future at all?
There's a connection to foreign policy. And over here.
Your Excellency. Thank you very much for your clear statement on India's role in the world. I'm curious to learn your views on China's role in the world, particularly in the Security Council and respect to China's relationship with the developing world. And if you can also address how do you see the Chinese-American relationship? Your Prime Minister was in the United States recently, and there was agreement to pursue nuclear cooperation, which is interpreted in some quarters as part of the U.S. encirclement of China. And right now, we have the Defense Minister of India visiting China, and I'm curious how you see China in this triangular relationship. Thank you.
Well, sir, I think you have the most extraordinary kind of gamut of questions there. If you can provide satisfactory answers to all those questions. wonderful.
But luckily, as a speaker, only I need to be satisfied. On Pakistan, I agree with you. It is indeed it is not an issue which can be talked away between India and Pakistan. Certainly not. But I believe that all the confidence building measures which we have undertaken and all the moves that are being made in Kashmir today itself, the movement that is taking place between the people, the fact that the LOC has been acquired border for such a long period, the fact of the openness of the center vis-a-vis all shades of political opinion, the fact that there is movement between India and Kashmir also on this points to the fact that there is political will on both sides to move the bilateral relationship generally together as well as this question. I think that trust and the confidence that you can come to an agreement through a mutual accommodation will increase the more you can develop a positive sum game towards each other, which is why I've always felt that greater movement on trade, greater movement on investment, greater movement on joining this intellectual capital globalization wave together is so important to create that trust. I often say that in the pre-partition days, people used to say that Lahore is the Oxford of India and Allahabad is the Cambridge of India. There's no difference at all which was made in intellectual capital capacity. All of it is still there. But all of it is now has to be drawn, and I think the synergy which can be created in South Asia as a whole, all the educated people of South Asia can lift this region into a sphere which is completely unforeseen by us, but which will surprise us. As far as the role in NAM is concerned, as I said, the previous formations have disappeared, but disempowerment hasn't gone. If you look at all the rounds we've had under GATT and now WTO, the Tokyo round did one thing. It had a generalized system of preferences. It had many features built into it so that trading activity, exporting activity could increase from developing country. We've come a long way. Now we have a development round. A development round means that agriculture has to have focus because that's the asset with most countries. Unless they're able to export what they have on the land, they have very little else. So it is the role of India today to conduct the debate in the way it is required and to play its role as an economy, which has also advanced a long way forward. The Indo-US nuclear deal, I didn't quite follow what you meant by pressure, because it's basically a way to enable the energy shortfall in India to be partially filled by an ability to have a civilian nuclear program in the country, which at present is not possible because of all the rules that are in existence. On the question of reservations, I think the Prime Minister has said that there are two huge points of view which have come up, and these will be there with us. One, don't compromise on your quality and efficiency. This is what is making India travel the distance it has traveled. And studies are being made. Indians are called, for instance, Sigma black belters in IT, which means they have the highest qualification their companies have. The highest qualification in IT, 60% is with Indian companies. Obviously, there is a perception that you are ahead of the curve and you're world beaters. You can't afford to compromise it. At the same time, there's a question of social equity and social empowerment and opportunity, which must be perceived to be also an aspect not only of performative delivery, but distributive justice in the country. And the Prime Minister has said that a policy is now under formulation with which both of these can be satisfied. And he's thrown a hint as to what this direction could be, which is a massive expansion of capacities and the creation of massive capacities so that both can be catered to. As for whether you should go back to India or not, it's entirely for you to decide. But you know, as Friedman has said, in the world is flat. The great revolution which has taken place in the world is that everyone can see everyone else, which is what he meant by the world is flat. I, as a pharmaceutical producer, see that my advantage lies in clinical testing, molecular and drug development, partly in India. The world is flat, I see that. The world no longer has a horizon beyond which some people disappear. So I always say, and I'm not sure whether it will be condoned by my own government, everyone must know what they want. In the huge intellectual terrain which is arising in the world, and find their place in it. Many people are going back to India from the north, and many are coming from India to the north. I don't know what you're studying, but you know, if I may say so, that is entirely your problem. As for China's role in the world, there is a misperception that India and China are in some kind of a competition with each other. I think we have, hopefully, a healthy envy of each other. I'll tell you a very interesting story. I mean, Chancellor Gordon Brown told me, if you can get your Minister of Finance to speak in my annual conference, which is called Advancing Enterprise, then we can have a great discussion, because I'll get the Minister of Finance of China as well. And, well, the Minister of Finance of China couldn't come, but he sent the Governor of the Bank of Central Bank of China. When his turn came to speak, he addressed not the audience, but our minister. And he says, I've heard all this, and I've read all this about India and China, how far ahead we are, and I'm glad we are. We started 13 years before you did, so that's all right. Question we are asking in Beijing, and I hope you can help us answer it, is this. If last year you got $5 billion worth of FDI, and I got $50 billion worth of FDI, which I did, how come your growth rate is the same as mine? Now, papers are being written. One is written by Harvard Business School. So many of them now, it's a whole literature of what constitutes real strength. What constitutes real strength is your ability to brand yourself as a global player today. It may take longer for India in some fields, but China has branded itself. Many of its multinationals have branded themselves. They have, you know, they have become the platform of manufacturing in so many things in the world. India has some way to go, but they will also brand themselves. And both countries will show their strengths. But a great strength, which in the end has to be coherence. Coherence between your politics, between your social policy, and your economic policy. One must not think that the race is only an economic one. Now, our trade with India, with China, only last year was about $1 billion a year. Now it is $1 billion every 3 weeks. We have heard the argument frequently made that the weight of global transactions and the economic weight of the world is shifting now from the West to the East and towards Asia. And I think both China and India understand that if you want this to be a positive factor for you, as far as global interaction is concerned, it can only be in partnership, and it cannot be in rivalry. I think both of us understand it very clearly. And no one should consider these huge civilizations and these giant countries as dominoes that can be moved around for the political interest of any other power. There's one interesting insight into how deep our relations are. In the 7th century, China produced, as so many other things, like the magnet and paper, the first book on movable types, the first printed book. The owner of what this book should be went to India, and an Indian scripture was printed, and it was translated by an Indian monk who came from India to Beijing and translated it from Sanskrit into Mandarin.
Do you feel able to take one more round? All right, okay. I have one more round. Your question has been answered.
Your Excellency, An ambassador has been very defined as an honest man who lies for his country. I don't know what your views on that are, but can I ask you, in terms of foreign policy, how does Indian foreign policy view a terrorist, or what is a terrorist? How do they define what is a terrorist?
Terrorist?
Yes. Would it be, for example, if I may simplify the question, would it be somebody, a member of Hamas or the Hamas government? Would it be the insurgents in Iraq? Would it be some people or the government of Israel? Would it be the Americans? Who would it be classed as a terrorist?
Who's classed as a terrorist? Can we just move the mic along, please, to the lady over here? Okay, it's already there.
I'm going to make the most of this opportunity that I've been given to take advantage of your expertise and ask you three questions, if I may. First of all, you mentioned this concept of human security, and I'm very interested to know how far you think India has made room, if any, for this concept in its own foreign policy, especially in the regional context, because I see this concept as something that could possibly bring more cohesiveness in the region. Secondly, SAARC, why do you think this is the time for it to be the vehicle for the region to progress as one? I personally don't see it happening unless there are some fundamental changes in the charter itself. And thirdly, and perhaps most interestingly for myself, in the 70s and 80s, we saw India intervening in the affairs of its neighbors in East Pakistan, in the Maldives, and in Sri Lanka. I'm very interested to know what India's foreign policy take is now in terms of intervening in the domestic affairs of its neighbors. Thank you.
If I might just really add to that question, it's sort of it's really very much the question I wanted to ask. I'm always struck when you speak with your and I admire your emphasis on the importance of the region, and in principle, yes, I entirely support that view. But like the last questioner, it does seem a little difficult to feel a great sense of optimism, given that, as I think the Prime Minister said before the SAARC summit in Dhaka in November. I mean, he didn't mention any particular state, but he referred to the problem of failing states in the region. And when one contemplates the state of affairs in Nepal, the state of affairs in Bangladesh, possibly in Sri Lanka as well, the problems of these of the near neighbours other than Pakistan, you know, strike me as being really major issues for India. And in that connection, it sometimes seems to me to be a matter for concern that certainly the way in which Indian diplomacy is regarded in Bangladesh, say, or in Nepal is actually of you know, the big brother, you know, the big boy in the shop, so to speak, throwing his weight around. I wonder how you regard the problems of those of the near neighbours other than Pakistan in relation to the objectives that you see as being so important for the region. Anyway, that was just my little twice as long gloss on that question. One more question, and then I'd like to let His Excellency answer.
Thank you. Very exciting and interesting predictions are being made about India. Let me take it a little bit further. If India were to emerge a hegemon, say in 50 years or whatever, how will it be different from the present hegemon? How will it be things differently? Thank
you. How would India be different than the present hegemon?
If it were to emerge as a hegemon, I mean, yes, as I said, it's a time, silly season it is, and that we are projecting some very exciting projections. Let's do it. And you're off the record, so probably you could speak, perhaps. Thank you.
What will India be like as a hegemon, is my understanding.
Well, as far as terrorism is concerned, there is now a pretty developed body in the United Nations Security Council of what international action on terrorism should be. The definition question has come up time and again. And I think by and large now people agree that there should be no act. There should be zero tolerance for any act which takes the lives of innocents, of civilians, non-combatants. At least that is the starting point. And this need not be embedded into any form of controversy. Human security question. There were two concepts which were floating around human security. One is loosely called the Canadian human security concept. The other was the Japanese one. The one was a little bit more interventionist than the other. But this has now taken a new turn. Human security is, as a term, I think a little bit overhauled by what has happened in the last 2 or 3 years in terms of the recognition of the MDGs, or the Millennium Development Goals. The Millennium Development Goals are very precise. By the year 2015, you should be able to have in health, in nourishment, in these the following advances. And your aid policy and all of this should be linked to that. So if you look at what India is doing in the field of MDGs, you find that you have a very, very long way to go. Not only that, because your figures, if they don't look good, then you find that the global figures are affected because you have hundreds or millions of people. And I think that we have a long way to go in infant mortality, maternal mortality, primary and secondary education, and nutrition. Because we've spoken of the demographic advantage which the country has. It will be an advantage only if you have a population which has real choices, and a population which feels there's a minimum of human dignity is available to them. And I think that whereas the record today is a very mixed one, it will only get better progressively because of the emphasis which is now being accorded to it. As for the general question of India and its neighbors, if you can, partly this is a question of the liability which a country must carry as a large neighbor. I think that every country must examine within itself what their own political systems are, how much of domestic governance quality is being introduced in that country, because I think the advancement of this whole region is dependent upon what each government is able to do for its own populations. We have to recognize the fact that this question of size which the country has does carry with it a special responsibility for the country. We have to be able to be mindful of what the other countries are saying about what the Indian economy, the impact it could have, and have firewalls built into your interaction so that they see it only as a positive-sum game without any negative consequences for themselves. I am not skeptical about SAARC for the reason that we have started on precisely this kind of discussion in SAARC, in technical cooperation and in trading. In the course of time, these difficulties will be allayed and the answers will have to be found. After all, when, as developing countries as a group, we interacted with the North, we had the same concerns of the weaker partner. And as our economy advances, then I think we have to recognize that we are also dealing in this sense as a weaker partner, as a stronger partner. India doesn't regard itself as a hegemon and should not regard itself as a hegemon. I think India should be seen by all neighbors only as a force, both in terms of the values it represents politically and in the role which it can play economically in the region as a benign partner, ally, and a friend. This certainly is the policy of the government of India, which it must conduct with all its neighbors. Thank you.
I think that with my apologies to those who still have questions that they would like to ask you, sir, I think that we should thank you very much indeed, both for your presentation and for the extremely spirited and interesting way in which you've answered a most extraordinary range of actually very, very difficult questions. I mean, very much the kind of questions which I think, you know, one should not write on both sides of the paper sort of thing, as it tells you in examinations. So thank you very, very much indeed for a most interesting evening. Thank you.